Welcome to the 227th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with New York Times bestselling author James Lee Burke. This is the third time that I've interviewed James Lee Burke. He is the author of the very popular Dave Robichaux series of mystery novels. In addition, Burke is a Breadloaf Fellow and Guggenheim Fellow, and he's been awarded two Edgar Awards for Best Novel of the Year, as well as the Grand Master Award by the Mystery Writers of America. Stay tuned for my interview with James Lee Burke. And just one audio note. Unfortunately, the audio of my questions in this interview is less than stellar. But bear with me, and you will hear the answers from James Lee Burke. Stay tuned for the interview.
Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is New York Times bestselling novelist James Lee Burke. Burke's latest novel, Robichaux, is the latest novel in the Dave Robichaux series featuring the former New Orleans detective. James Lee Burke, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on your show again.
Sure. Well, can you read the first couple of pages of your new novel, Robichaux?
Well, I have a copy right here in front of me, and I'll start out right now. Like an early 19th century poet, when I have melancholy moments and feel the world is too much for us, and that late and soon we lay waste to our powers in getting and spending, I'm forced to pause and reflect upon my experiences with the dead and the hold they exert on our lives. This may seem a macabre perspective on one's life, but at a certain point, it seems to be the only one we have. Mortality is not kind, and do not let anyone tell you it is. If there is such a thing as wisdom, and I have serious doubts about its presence in my own life, it lies in the acceptance of the human condition, and perhaps the knowledge that those who have passed on are still with us, out there in the mist, showing us the way, sometimes uttering a word of caution from the shadows, sometimes visiting us in our sleep, as bright as a candle burning inside a basement that has no windows. On a winter morning, among white clouds of fog out at Spanish Lake, I would see the boys in butternut splashing their way through the flooded cypress, their muskets held above their heads, their equipment tied with rags so it wouldn't rattle. I was standing no more than 10 feet from them, although they took no notice of me, as though they knew I had not been born yet, and their travail and sacrifice were not mine to bear. Their faces were lean from privation, as pale as wax, their hair uncut, the rents in their uniforms stitched clumsily with string. Their mouths were pinched, their eyes luminous with caution. The youngest soldier, a drummer boy, could not have been older than 12. On one occasion, I stepped into the water to join them. Even then, none acknowledged my presence. The drummer boy stumbled and couldn't right himself, struggling with the leather strap around his neck and the weight of his drum. I reached out to help him and felt my hand and arm sink through his shoulder. A shaft of sunlight pierced the canopy, turning the fog into white silk. In less than a second, the column was gone. Long ago, I ceased trying to explain events such as these to either myself or others. Like many my age, I believe people in groups are to be feared, and that arguing with others is folly, and the knowledge of one generation cannot be passed down to the next. Those may seem cynical sentiments, but there are certain truths you keep inside you and do not defend, lest you cheapen and then lose them altogether. those truths have less to do with the dead than the awareness that we are no different from them, that they are still with us and we are still with them, and there is no afterlife but only one life, a continuum in which all time occurs at once, like a dream inside the mind of God. Why should an old man, thrice widowed, dwell on things that are not demonstrable and have nothing to do with the reasonable view of the world? Because only yesterday, on a broken sidewalk in a shabby neighborhood at the bottom of St. Claude Avenue in the lower Ninth Ward of St. Bernard Parish, under a colonnade that was still twisted out of shape by Katrina, across from a liquor store with barred windows that stood under a live oak probably 200 years old, I saw a platoon of Confederate infantry march out of a field to the tune of Darling Nellie Gray and disappear through the wall of a gutted building and not exit on the other side.
Great. Well, if someone listening... If someone listening hasn't heard about Robichaux yet, how would you describe your new novel?
Well, it's the 21st in a series narrated by the same character. And there, most of these novels are set in New Iberia or close by, and also they wander sometimes to Texas and to Florida and to Colorado and Montana. Dave Robichaux is less a participant than a witness to history. He's the everyman figure out of the medieval plays. The stories are out of Elizabethan theater and the Bible and classical antiquity, Greek mythology. That's where the stories come from.
And do you remember when you started thinking about Robichaux? Do you have any memory of like the original idea that led you to writing this novel?
Oh yes, because it changed my whole career, changed my life, no question about it. I started writing when I was quite young, and I published my first story in the SLI. It's the University of Louisiana now literary magazine. When I was 19 years old, I never wanted to be anything other than a writer since. Actually, I started writing when I was in the fifth grade, not very well, but I wanted to be a writer back then. Anyway, I published three novels in New York during my early career. My first novel I finished when I was 23 years old, and it received a six-column banner review in the New York Times Sunday insert, the New York Times Literary Review. I never got a review that big, but it was my first one. And then I published two more, and I thought I was home free. Wow, was I wrong. I went 13 years in the middle of my career, and I couldn't sell anything. And I don't know how many rejection slips I received. They were in the hundreds. I wrote other novels that are still not published. And I was fishing with a friend of mine, Rick DeMarinas, who's also a novelist, and we were in the Bitterroot, standing in the water in the Bitterroot River up here in Montana. And he said, "Jim, you've written every other kind of book. Why don't you try a crime novel?" He said, "If you write two chapters, you can probably get an advance." And I'd never thought about what... Actually, my earlier novels were crime novels. But anyway, I thought about it. And 3 days later, Pearl, my wife Pearl, and our little girl, Alfair, we're in San Francisco, right down the street from Lawrence Ferland Getty's bookstore, the City Lights bookstore. And I bought a legal pad, one of those yellow legal pads, and I walked about a block up the street from Ferlinghetti's place and sat down in an outdoor cafe, an Italian cafe across from a Catholic church. And I started writing the first chapter in longhand of The Neon Rain. And I wrote two chapters, and I sent them to my old friend Charles Williford, you know, who's a crime novelist. And I knew Charles for 20 years, and he was a great guy. And he wrote me back, and he said, "Jim, you may have created one of the most memorable crime story narrators or cops in American literature." You know, it's pretty good coming from Charles, because he was a hardcore writer. I mean, he was a guy that kept the standard. Charles didn't give an inch when it came to his art. But, you know, I knew Charles all these years. He was in the Horse Cavalry in 1936 at Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. And in World War II, he went into armor. And at the Battle of Arnhem, he took his tank, the Sherman tank, through German lines and picked up 23 grunts. He piled them on his tank and took them all home. And he received the Silver Star and the Quarter Gear. He would never talk about it. Nobody knew that story. And I said, "Charles, why don't you write about your war years?" And he said, "Ah, James Jones and those fellows have done all that. I don't know who those fellows are. Those fellows have done all that." But he was a great writer. Anyway, that was it. But that's the creation of Dave Robichaux. And the character himself comes from those failed novels that I never published. I wrote a novel about a young Cajun Golden Gloves fighter named Dave Robichaux, who falls in love with a young woman who lives out by Spanish Lake, Bootsy Mouton. And it was a young lover's story. But that character and Bootsy Mouton and New Iberia became my obsession for quite a while. And I told you I'd been out of print 13 years. My novel, The Lost Get Back Boogie, had been rejected 111 times over 9 years of submission. I sent it to LSU Press, and my wife had been telling me to do that for I don't know how long. They published it, and it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and I had just finished The Neon Rain, and I sent it to New York, and three or five publishers bid on it. I couldn't believe it. And the third book in the series went up for auction, and it allowed us to quit our jobs, and we were living in the Midwest and buy a house up on a creek, you know, way on up a canyon in old Montana. This is a perfect place. It's like day one there. It's the first day of creation up there. And it's a great, we had wood stoves, and we had our own well, and we're on a creek. The water was absolutely pure. It's like Perrier. It's never felt the influences of the industrial age. We had a subterranean lake under the house. But anyway, and then we were off and running, and I wrote other books, you know, the Holland books, and I wrote one book about the Civil War called The White Doves at Morning. That it's one of my best books, actually. It takes place at Shiloh and around New Iberia and deals with the invasion of southwest Louisiana by Nathaniel Banks in 1862 and the White League and, you know, the things that occurred in the immediate aftermath of the war. You know, the White League was worse than the Klan. You know, it was a very violent time. But anyway,
right. Well, this latest, This latest Robichaud novel, do you remember kind of what led you or what idea you had when you sat down to originally work on that?
A first-person narrator is a challenge to the author for the following reason. The worst pronouns in the English language are I, me, my, mine, and myself, because they all deal with the ego. And the character has to be a sympathetic one. Washington Irving once said, one of the greatest forms of intimacy and the purest form is a relationship between an author and his audience. There's a reciprocity of trust there. And that first-person narrator has to be someone whom we admire and whom we trust. And Dave is that figure. He's the blue-collar knight errant. He has his origins in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, The Good Knight. He's also the knight errant in the Mordor Tour by Thomas Mowry, the Arthurian knight in The Search for the Grail. It's also a reflection, emanation, I guess, of Cervantes, Sancho Panza, and, you know, the story of Sancho Panza and Don Quixote. Dave is the idealist, Don Quixote, in rusty armor charging at windmills, and his sidekick is Cleet Purcell, or Sancho Panza, the trickster, who gets even for the rest of us. Every high school has got one guy like Cleet Purcell. If you think back upon it, you remember that guy? All you had to do was dare him to do something, and he was on it. It didn't matter how bizarre or crazy it was. The kind of guy who would make a good kamikaze pilot in the Japanese Air Force. Guy is just sowing mayhem and chaos wherever he goes.
I think that's a good description of Cleet.
That's Cleet Purcell.
So you've mentioned in previous interviews that you write very instinctively in terms of plotting and narrative, and I know you've taught writing in the past. How would you describe your writing process to someone if they were sitting in your class as a student? How does the work happen for you?
Well, it isn't really work. If a person is, let's say, an artist, it doesn't matter what art he pursues. The medium is irrelevant. Whether he's a sculptor, a painter, an actor, a musician, a poet, a novelist, that person knows that he has a gift. And it seems like a presumption of vanity, but he knows it. And it's the way a ball player knows that he's a pitcher when he picks up the ball. And it's like his fingers were made to curl around the stitches on that ball. And he doesn't care what other people think of him, whether they reject him. He reaches a point in his life when he doesn't hear either the boos or the applause. That he knows that he was given a votive gift, and it was extended to him by a hand outside of himself. Every artist knows that. And the day that he takes the gift for granted and the day he becomes vain about it and egocentric is the day he loses it. I have never seen the exception. The worst of the worst know that. They never tamper with it. But it's there for a reason. And so you don't... you're never not writing. A real writer is always writing. I used to tell students that the way to learn to write dialogue is to listen. It's out there already. The lines are there. You have to hear them. And you can sit in a cafe and overhear people talking. Say, my heavens, This is out of Shakespeare. But a good writer is a good listener. You see, and the other advice I used to give students is never read bad writing. Only read the good guys, the people who did it well, whether it's William Shakespeare, John Steinbeck, or James T. Farrell, or Stephen Crane, or, you know, we have so many great American writers. We have the most literary tradition in the world. We're always praising the Brits and the Greeks and the French. And yeah, they deserve praise, but I don't think within the short period of our country's history, I mean, we've only been around a little over a couple hundred years. Look at the writers America has produced. They often find recognition overseas before they find it in their own home. But, you know, Faulkner was completely out of print 1 year before he won, 1 or 2 years before the Nobel Prize was given him. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 1938. 1948, he was out of print. I think the New York Times once referred to him as the poet of the southern dung heap. How about that? From the hometown crowd. New York Times. My friend, I tell you, Charles, my friend Charles in Miami, you know, he waited years to get a review in the New York Times. And I remember when the review ran, the first line was, Charles Williford's protagonist, a private eye, Charles Williford's protagonist, no, he's a homicide cop, has no business, is a clod who has no business using psychology on anyone. Charles said, I waited 20 that Times review, and the guy calls my main character a clod. Use psychology on anyone.
So what are you working on now? Are you writing a new novel?
I'm writing a sequel to Robichaud, to the novel that's coming out January 2nd. I am writing a sequel to it, and its title is Ball and Chain. It's from the song, you know, Ball and Chain, Big Mama Thornton.
Sure.
My last three novels were a trilogy, comprised a trilogy, and I think it's the best work I've ever done. The three novels titled Wayfaring Stranger, House of the Rising Sun, and The Jealous Kind, that I have hopes to, I'm trying to maybe organize something in the way of a cable series, but it's an epic story about the American West. But I think maybe Dave Robichaud, and this is what other people say, this novel, Robichaud, is the best in the series. I believe it is.
That's great. So what other advice would you have for aspiring writers who may be listening to this?
You never quit. You never quit. I learned a lesson when I was just a young guy. I worked offshore, oil exploration a little bit, 10 days on, 5 days off. And I didn't have a residence. When I get back on land, I just find friends to stay with for 5 days, but I'd write all those 5 days. And I rented a mailbox at the post office in Lafayette. And I would put my stories and poems into envelopes before I went back on the quarter boat. I'd mail them off the envelopes, and the rejections would be waiting for me when I got off the hitch, when I came back on land. But I learned a system. Never let a manuscript stay home longer than 36 hours. 1.5 days, and it's back in the mail. You never give it up. If you leave your manuscript in a drawer, you assure that you will be a failure. You just leave it out there, and you go on to the next piece of work. You just wear them down, and you never listen to the naysayers. More people will try to discourage you than will try to encourage you. And there are those who can really be mean. And they sense sometimes as a gift in someone else that they will never have themselves, and you don't listen to them. Did you ever see the film Amadeus, the story of Mozart? Did you see that? It's the story of a genius who was, envied Salieri, who he was so jolly. He despised Amadeus, and because he did not have the gift that Amadeus has. But that's what I mean when I say that you make a private contract with your higher power. You know you have the gift. And if you just stay true to your own vision, to your own inclinations as an artist, and if you write every day and try to make the world a better place with it, the success will find you. I remember something a great writer named Irving Stone once said. He came to our little writing group at SLI in 1956 and talked to about 10 or 11 of us. And he said, never write a poem or a story to pay the light bill. If you do, you can be assured your utilities will be cut off. Don't write for money, because you'll never make any. The money and the fame find the author. But if he writes for those things, he will never have success of any kind.
That's good advice.
So
you mentioned earlier you remember riding in the fifth grade, and you also mentioned working offshore and then coming back and putting your stories in the mail. Do you remember, like, at what point, at what age did you finally, after fifth grade, what age were you when you finally decided this is it for me and I'm going to try to pursue it? Didn't it have something to do with your cousin?
Yeah, with my cousin Andre Dubuse. Andre was one grade ahead of me. He was 4 months older than I and 1 year ahead of me in school. But when he was a freshman at McNeese College in Lake Charles, he won first place in the Louisiana college writing competition. And I thought, I've got to give that a try. And the next year, when I was a freshman at Southwestern Louisiana Institute, I entered a short story, and I won an honorable mention. And I was really very proud of that. And Andre and I, he's passed away now, but we were very close when we were young, and we always encouraged each other, and Andre was probably the best short story writer of his time. I still think he is. He wrote perhaps 20 stories that are perfect stories. Hemingway wrote probably 5. Faulkner wrote 5 that are perfect stories. Andre wrote 20. But you see, he came along at a time when what was called metafiction was a fashion, and Ray Carver and Bob Bartholomew were more or less icons at that time. I'm not taking away from them. And Ray Carver was a great writer, but Andre was better. Andre was leagues beyond the work of those guys, and they were great guys. Andre was, he wrote stories that are just haunting. You never forget them. most of them are set around Boston or around Lafayette and Lake Charles. That's where he grew up.
And so was that kind of competition with him? Is that what kind of got you started?
No, it wasn't competition. No. It's, you don't compete with anybody. Nobody does that, really. I mean, people say it for fun, but it's not what it's about. It's not what it's about. Ernest Hemingway put it this way. If you believe them when they say you're good, you have to believe them when they say you're bad. That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, again, we've been speaking with James Lee Burke. His latest novel, Robichaux, is in bookstores today, so you can go grab a copy. And, Jim, thanks for doing this interview.
Hey, well, Jeff, thanks a million. It's nice to be in touch with you again. It's an honor to be on your show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.